Welcome to Journey into Excellence. My name is Vernon Bohr, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Journey into Excellence is an ongoing series where experts in their field focus on how evidence-based promotion of life, liberty, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. Each of our expert panelists brings something unique to discussion. I'm delighted to announce new this year on our panel is Dr. Catherine Cooley. Dr. Cooley has been teaching in Council for Accreditation of Counseling and Related Educational Programs, accredited graduate and doctoral counseling program since 2006. She's a licensed mental health counselor in the state of Florida and a national certified counselor. Dr. Cooley has experience working with children and families in both the private and public sectors and has specialized in treating survivors of domestic violence and sexual abuse. She has also provided supervision to counselors and training for the past 14 years. Dr. Cooley has published in professional journals and has presented at community, state, national, and international conferences and workshops. Her research interests include diversity, social justice, and advocacy issues related to the counseling profession. She is also an advocate in her community, sharing stories through a photography project, Faces of Faye. She has previously completed a veteran suicide awareness photography series, a military spouse series, and is currently working on a diversity series through this effort. Our returning panelists are Jack Malcolm, president of the Falcon Performance Group, an organization dedicated to improving the professionalism, preparation, and productivity of sales professionals in complex sales environments, and Dr. Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, LLC, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. And with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Dr. Higley to both bring us up to date where we've been from whence we've come and to where we're headed to in this third season of our series on Journey into Excellence. So take it away, Brian.
Okay, thanks, Vern. Well, what I thought I would do is spend some time summarizing, as you say, where we've been. And I wouldn't mind personally, if the rest of the panel doesn't either, spending a good amount of time, 30, even 45 minutes if we wanted to, kind of catching everybody up on where we've been, because it's been quite a little bit of time since our last episode. And then after we do a little bit of wandering through where we've been, I thought I'd put a proposal out to the group on where we'll go from here. So here's my brief summary of where we've been. And what I'm hoping this brief summary will do is trigger a few thoughts in everybody's mind so that we can talk a little bit about where we've been. So if you might want to take some notes, or if anything sort of pops up in your mind as I do this brief summary, things that you want to say, some things that you think I might have missed, some things that you think I might have mistaken, feel free to be prepared for that. So we have been, as the title of the show implies, we've been looking into excellence. And I think all of you might remember that I like to use the acronym H2O because I think excellence is health to ourselves and others. So we've been looking at excellence through a couple of different lenses. And one of the first lenses we looked at in the first season was Carl Rogers' person-centered approach to excellence. And he focused on what I call the GREs, genuineness, regard, and empathy. And he did a lot of science, and other people after him have done a lot of science on how helpful genuineness, regard, and empathy is to ourselves and others. So I thought that was a good model for us to explore this H2O-centered excellence idea through. We then moved on to the Duluth model, and I think about this model as abuse reduction model, and we looked into the differences between the power and control wheel and the equality wheel. I sometimes think about the power and control wheel as the abuse wheel. I sometimes think of the equality wheel as the GRE, genuine regard and empathy wheel. So we contrasted different spokes on the wheel. There's 8 spokes on these wheels. One of the spokes that I most like to dive into in these two wheels is the difference between the equality wheel's honesty and accountability, which I think is helpful to ourselves and others, and the power and control wheel's minimization, denial, blame, and distortion, which I think is harmful or abusive to other people as well. And one of the things that we dove into when we were looking into the difference between honesty and accountability and minimization, denial, blame, and distortion are common logical fallacies. And those, as I think all of you, and certainly I know, Vern, you know how important those logical fallacies are to me, because not only do I think those sort of freeing ourselves from those fallacies help us to be more accurate, more honest, and accountable, but I think it also decreases the probability that we'll be abusive to either ourselves and others. And then the other model that I'll talk about, and then I'll see what, if anything, got triggered in your mind from this brief review. The other model that we went through was Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey model. And I like to think that journeying from power and control strategy and tactics to equality wheel or GRE-centered strategies and tactics is truly heroic. So when people are thinking about moving from the power and control wheel to the equality wheel, I think they're actually doing a very heroic journey. And we talked about the 3 different phases of that journey: separation, and for the purposes of our discussion, we talked about how to separate from power and control strategy and tactics. The next phase in the hero's journey, initiation, how to initiate ourselves and others into more equality or GRE-centered ways of being. And then return, how to return to our family systems, our education systems, and our work systems, leadership management, political systems, and help others to take the heroic journey from the more power and control ways of being to the more GRE, equality wheel-centered ways of being. So that's my quick sort of overview of where we've been in terms of exploring excellence and talking about different ways to spread it. And now I'd be really interested to hear what, if anything, got triggered in everybody else's mind as I've did a quick review of where we've been.
Don't all speak at once. Yeah, okay, I'll lead off, and and anyone can interrupt me at any particular time. Point in time is, and it was triggered as I'm listening to you go through this. I don't think we've ever really taken the time to do something very simple, and that is look at what the phrase journey into excellence means. So I did a quick thing. A journey is an act of traveling from one place to another. And as you talked about the power and control wheel to moving toward the cooperation wheel, Brian, that's traveling mm-hmm. from one point of view to another. Mm. It's going from one place to another. Joseph Campbell's, the hero's journey is taking yourself from starting at one place to another. And I thought it was interesting that the definition of excellence is the quality of being outstanding or extremely good. And what came to mind, and then I'm going to shut up here, is the composition of our panel as I think about Jack in the business world. We're living in an integrated society and world, and you and Kathy and your respective worlds of both education and counseling and psychology and everything else, those are the things that came to my mind. We're on a journey into excellence. We're going from where we are, wherever that is, wherever, and we may be stuck or not stuck, and moving to being outstanding or extremely good. And I would say in our relationship with respect to those we love and others, as you say, help to self and others. And that also has that aspect of our interrelationship with our communities and organizations and things like that.
Vern, if I could just piggyback off what you said, something struck me when you were going through the three words, journey into excellence. And I want to focus on that word into. I wonder if it might be more appropriate in a lot of cases to say journey towards excellence, not necessarily into, because that denotes a destination that you can achieve, you will achieve, and sometimes you don't even know if you have achieved it. But you should always be striving to move in that direction.
I like it, Jack. I'm going to change the title on all the past shows, too.
Well, and I don't have any other comments on Brian's summary. I thought it was a good, concise summary, but I just had to focus on one word.
I think that's brilliant.
Jack, I'll jump in really quickly. Your commentary made me go back to Carl Rogers' model, and he thought that the outcome of enough genuineness, regard, and empathy was a fully functioning person, and he was really big on staying away from EDs and staying with INGs that were always in process. So you made me think of Carl Rogers' model when you were suggesting our an edited title. I appreciate it.
Sure.
You know, if I can add something real quick, as I was listening to you kind of summarize this, I know we've talked about this so many times, but there is something to be said about a summary, because what came to me was a visual of someone overcoming so many barriers as they go from this power and control life into the quality life, and just overcoming those barriers and how that can very much become part of the heroic journey that's rewarding and that's adventure filled, and just having that shift in perspective. I know for me, it's been very powerful. So that's kind of the imagery that came to me, was just someone kind of jumping over hurdles and getting over them and really engaging with this journey and making it a fun thing that's welcomed. Bring on the barriers. Let's go. You know? So that's kind of what was going through my head as you were talking, Brian.
You know, Catherine, that brings to mind, I just heard a comment by John Voight recently on an interview, and he was said that one of the things that shifted his life is he was struggling as, why does life have to be so hard? And the way he put it, and all of a sudden he heard God speak to him, is how he put it. And he says, and God told me it's supposed to be hard. If it's easy, there's no challenge. And it strikes me in this world where so many people seem to be so bored and jaded that it's easy to miss the opportunity, that the speed bumps and challenges that you mentioned, Kathy, are part of the journey. I mean, I remember in 2012, my wife was in her second bout of cancer, and a bunch of things were going on. And I thought, you know, if I can just start to hold life as an adventure, which in a journey is, adventures have all of it included. They're joyful, they're boring, they're scary. Life is kind of all of it. And somehow it strikes me that we often try and avoid those bumps in life that make us stronger.
You all are making me think of the stage in the initiation phase of Campbell's journey called the Road of Trials. And I think we already covered this in earlier podcasts. And Kathy, I know you and I have talked about this in our one-on-one talks. But the hero's journey was a major influence to George Lucas when he made the first three Star Wars films. And I was reminded, as you all were talking, of an interview that Campbell did with, I think it was Bill Moyers, many years ago. And Moyers said, so the role of the Empire in these movies is so that the Jedi Knights have something to defeat. And Campbell said, oh, no, 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 no. So the Empire is the anvil upon which the Jedi Knight is forged. And that immediately made me think of this road of trials. And if people can think of the trials or the barriers, as Kathy said, that they encounter as mechanisms by which they are becoming forged into something better, into something bigger, broader, into something that's more well-prepared to take on what it is they need to take on and live the life that they're meant to live. These barriers, I think, move in one's consciousness from things to complain about to things to embrace, or as Kathy, as I think you said, bring them on. So something needs to forge me into something that is like a Jedi Knight, then bring that forging on.
How does that translate into the business world, Jack?
Well, it's kind of funny. One thing that came to mind as you were talking, I was thinking from the business aspect, and I wasn't even going to bring it up because I thought it was just too pedestrian for this conversation. But since you ask, from a sales aspect, I always tell people the purpose of any salesperson's conversation with a client is to uncover conflict, because your job is to find a need, and the only way you find a need is you improve their outcomes, and the only way you improve outcomes is by removing conflicts. And it's kind of a coincidence, but I call it the storyboard approach to selling, or the storyboard approach to business. Is you understand their situation, you develop the conflict, and then together you work on a resolution to that. And that doesn't have the advantage of Joseph Campbell's, 14 or 18 different stages of the story. But it was like Kurt Vonnegut said, get a man into a hole, get him out again, and that's the essence of a novel. That's the essence of business as well.
That sounds like good practical advice in everyday life, period, whether it be families, community, friendships, whatever, Jack.
And the key is that the resolution, you can't impose it on other people. You have to work with them to bring it out in them to work together for a resolution.
Jack, given the fact that you're talking about salesmanship, it just takes me back to someone that said this one time, is that you never sell anyone anything. You just encourage them to fulfill that which they already want. And I often thought about that my growing up. People talked about cigarette ads and other ads I see on television. That's never the reason I buy stuff. I either want it or not. Maybe the ads on television, whether it be for, in the old days, cigarettes, or whether it be for potato chips or something, may have something to do with the particular product that I choose. But I didn't start smoking when I was younger because of television ads and the Marlboro Man and everything. I did it because my friends were doing it and stuff. They were incidental to maybe the Marlboro versus Winston versus Camel, all things that y'all are maybe too young to remember. But
yeah, and I guess it depends on how you define what you want, because a lot of people think they want something, but they don't really know what they want. And sometimes a good salesperson can really show them what they need rather than what they want. And that, without getting too deep into the ins and outs of how you do that, that's kind of my philosophy, is people don't always know what they want. But working together, we can uncover what they need, and we can see if we can get them to fulfill that need.
Jack, you're making me think of Carl Rogers again, and I'm switching from sales of potato chips and cigarettes to helping people to live the lives that they want to live. And I think that is as good a summary of his approach to therapy, education, and probably life. Being what Joseph Campbell might call a fellow journeyer or somebody who provides people with unexpected aid. And I think it's been my experience that a lot of people, whether it's people in a family system or an education system or work system, have often been kind of told what it is that they should want. I think it's a power control technique of, instead of asking people, well, what is it that you want, they instead say, these are the things that you ought to want, and here's why you ought to want them. And I think so much of what you're talking about in sales, and we've talked about this idea of the maybe the most excellent salesperson is this trusted advisor, which I think would fit right in with the unexpected aid stage in the hero's journey, symbolized, by the way, in Star Wars by Obi-Wan Kenobi, who needed to sell the idea to Luke Skywalker of actually becoming a Jedi Knight. For those of you who remember those old movies, at first Luke did not want to be a Jedi Knight. I think so much of what needs to happen, whether it be a good salesperson, a good therapist, a good educator, a good friend, is to help people explore in a really deep and meaningful way, what are my most important objectives? What are my most important goals? What are my values? And I think one of the reasons why so many systems struggle, or they get into these metaphorical holes that you talked about, and so many holes that I've encountered both personally and professionally have been a function of sort of power and control kinds of strategies being used. The way out of that hole is really asking people, well, what is it that you actually want? What is it that you truly need? And to me, those are the most those are the advisors most worthy of trust, whether it's the salesperson, the therapist, the teacher, or leader.
Yeah, there's a fairly recent book out called Wanting by Luke Burgess. I don't know if you've heard of it. And the subtitle is Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life. And basically, mimetic desire simply says that a lot of what we want, we only want it because other people have it. We see what models do. So, like, for example, Vern, you were talking about when you started smoking. What brand did you end up choosing to smoke?
Well, we chose Marlboro and Winston. And then Lucky Strike.
Exactly why you chose that.
Friends were doing it.
Because everybody else was doing it, right?
Yeah.
Or
absolutely.
The cool kids were doing it. Or you know, the ads made you look like you'd be cool like a cowboy or something, I guess, if you smoked
right.
Marlboro. And I'm not to belittle that, but we all do that. You know, what kind of car do you drive? Well, maybe the car you drive, you tell yourself, oh, I bought it because of it's got these characteristics and these features and all that. When deep down, you really liked it because your neighbor down the street had one and you wanted to top them or something like that. So, again, we don't always know what we want or why we want it.
Jack, I'm going to get into trouble here because I think it starts at a very young age, you know, and they lived happily ever after.
Yep.
You know, the prince on the knight in shining armor saving the maiden, and, you know, when you... where the rubber meets the road, doesn't always look like that.
Well, Burgess actually cites research that shows that even infants under a year old will choose toys based on what other infants are doing. They pay attention to what's going on, and they want to, you know, you want to fit in. So you want to do what everybody else is doing.
Jack, what you're talking about strikes me that old metaphor of three great mysteries in life are air to the bird, water to the fish, and us to ourselves. We live in a sea of, in fact, this was a kind of a story.
Can we take a second so I can write that one down?
Air, water to the fish,
yes.
Human beings to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the man most easy to con is the man that doesn't believe he can be conned. You know, I'm a senior citizen, guys, and I always laugh when I see people on the news. Well, they got bilked by some con man that says, he seems so. This is tangential, by the way. He seems so nice and honest. Well, a con man that looks like a con man is not very successful. So, if he looks sleazy and he's going to cheat you, even though he could be the most honest man in the world, we're wary. And you're absolutely right. That's our social interaction, as far as I'm concerned, that we're talking about. And actually, in terms of what Brian has put out, in terms of where we will wind up going this season, is, as I told him, we're actually, once you master the hero's journey for yourself and all this stuff, what you're faced with is a society in which you live are human beings to human beings, and how are we going to work together effectively in such a fashion that we're all best served?
You know, this is something that, and I'd love, Kathy, if you have thoughts on this, I'd love you to chime in on this. But as we were talking, as Vern and Jack were talking, I thought of a couple of things. One is the difference between conformity, compliance, and obedience, and life, liberty, and happiness pursuit. And then I also thought of a couple of the different spokes on the power control wheel versus the equality wheel. So I'll just say these things and then see, Kathy, if you have any thoughts.
Sure.
But a lot of this conformity, compliance, and obedience stuff, I think, is rooted in these spokes of the power control wheel. Use of coercion and threats, use of intimidation, use of emotional abuse, use of isolation. All of these things, I think, are related to some of the things that Jack and Vern were talking about, from, I better smoke cigarettes or I won't be included or I won't be cool, to all kinds of different choices that might not actually be an individual's choice. It's just something that was sort of thrust upon them. And then the other spokes, the more GRE-centered equality wheel, negotiation and fairness. Did anybody negotiate with Vern about should I smoke at all? What brand should I use? All these things. Non-threatening behavior. Behavior that's associated with you're going to be okay whether or not you smoke and whether or not you smoke the cool brand, respect, no matter what it is that you choose, smoking, not smoking, I'm still going to respect you, and trust and support. So I don't know, Kathy, if you have anything to say, but I immediately thought of conformity, compliance, and obedience versus life, liberty, happiness, pursuit, and that the difference between coercion and threats, intimidation, emotional abuse, and isolation, and negotiation, non-threatening behavior, respect, and trust and support.
Absolutely. As I listened to you speak, I couldn't help but think of all the systems that we're a part of, and whether it's at work or in your marriage or in your community, it takes a great deal of courage for you. And I always think of Brene Brown and her whole courage over comfort, that was meaningful in my own life. And as I think of that courage that it takes for you to kind of break free from the manipulation that happens in a lot of different systems, and have a mind of your own and value yourself and kind of put yourself out there to really find the meaningful stuff and the joy and lean into what feels good and what, where the energy is, kind of go where the energy is. It's life-changing. Mm-hmm. And I think, like I said, it just takes a lot of courage for you to make the decision to break free from that power and control wheel and shift your life, no matter what system you're looking at, because it happens across systems. I mean, I've seen it in the workplace. I've seen it across systems. So just taking a good inventory of your life and the various systems that you're a part of and where you might need to take a little extra courage, I think is really important. And that's kind of what's coming to mind right now, Brian.
Mm. Good word, courage.
Don't all speak at once. Listen.
Well, you know what?
Go ahead. Thank you, Gabby.
Well, Vern, I was thinking earlier when Jack was talking about, you know, the salesperson and the barriers that they face and whatnot and the road of trials, I couldn't help but think of entrepreneurs and how many times have they failed or fallen, you know, with an idea that was unique to them that they valued and they thought was awesome. And then, it takes courage. They have to have courage to try again and try again and try again until something clicks. And all of a sudden you find yourself co-creating something amazing that everyone loves. but I think courage is key to all of this.
Well,
sometimes it takes the opposite. Having worked for myself for 26 years now, sometimes the opposite of courage, it can be the greatest motivating force to just keep going because the fear of failure.
Mm.
So, you know, I know that we all focus on the positive side of things, but there's some useful to the negative, in which case I guess it's not negative, but now I'm playing with words.
Oh, I was actually going to jump in and say the very thing you just said, Jack. I couldn't agree more. I think that part of maybe mastering the road of trials, because when we're talking about courage, we're talking about fear. And then, again, I'm thinking of Carl Rogers and the fully functioning person and his encouragement to be what you genuinely are. So if you're feeling courageous, be that. If you're feeling fearful, be that. Now I'm thinking a little bit of the evolutionary psychologists who emphasize the utility of everything that still remains in our consciousness. So if fear is common, it must be that it's useful. If courage is something that we find on a regular basis, it must be useful. And I think part of mastering the hero's journey, and I'm thinking again of the road of trials, is starting to understand that everything that emerges, not only, I guess, in the external world, we talked about barriers and things that can get in our way, but also everything that emerges internally, that they're all tools for you on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings me to the penultimate stage in Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. It's called the master of the two worlds. And so one of the things that Campbell encourages people to be aware of, to be focused on, and to use the metaphor of the Jedi Knight, to train yourself in, is to gain more and more mastery of what's happening around you and inside of you. And once you get more mastery of that, you're ready for the final stage, which overlaps with a lot of what we've been talking about. Fern mentioned it in the intro. More life, liberty, happiness pursuit. Well, that always makes me think of the final stage in Campbell's model, freedom to live. The more you're a master of two worlds, the internal world and the external world, the more free you are to be who you are, which then also brings me back to Roger's focus on the GREs.
When you said all tools, it just sparks different thoughts. So if I'm not going right with what you said, please forgive me. But it sparked a different thought here. It goes back to what we said earlier. We talked about seeing things as a challenge rather than a problem. And the thought that when you mentioned tools is that one of the best ways to move on when you're challenged is to look at the situation and say, what use can I make out of this? So when you said fear and all these things from an evolutionary psychology standpoint must be useful somehow, whatever you're feeling probably can be useful, I guess, if you know yourself well enough.
Mm. And I think so much of this conformity, compliance, obedience, tendency in the world, in these different systems, like Kathy talked about, just gets in again to Roger stuff, but I also think it's a quality wheel, and I also think it's Hero's Journey stuff, is so often we're told by people who may know almost nothing about how to master the internal and external world, and in many cases, the odds are that they don't know very much about that. But they're here from the beginning in our family system. They continue in the education system and on into the work system. So we encounter throughout our entire lives people telling us, don't be who you are. Don't feel what you feel. Big girls don't cry. Real men aren't scared, whatever. And I think so much of what we're talking about in terms of authentic excellence is to liberate ourselves from those fallacies. One of the fallacies we talked about in season one was appeal to the bandwagon. Just because everybody's saying it or believing it doesn't mean it's true. And I think so much of the hero's journey is separating from those kinds of fallacies, that there are certain things in our internal world that we must minimize, deny, or distort, to use some terminology from the power and control wheel, rather than really sit with, understand, think about, and utilize. And I think maybe that's one of our biggest mistakes. Certainly Rogers wrote extensively about this. One of our biggest mistakes is that we're so often encouraged not to be the self that we truly are.
You know what? Something that comes up here that's very, for me, I consider very profound is like Jack says.
Vern, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I just, something we, you know, part of the technology, sometimes stuff comes through kind of garbled. What strikes me out of what Jack was talking about in sales, what's often or maybe always very important is finding out what the other person really wants. And that's something that can be very hard to do. And where it comes to being a human, the same thing. I think it's very, we think we know what we want, but very rarely do we ever really question what we think we want. You know, a lot of life is kind of on autopilot, or so it seems to me at this point in my life. And we have all these notions of what life is about. And in terms of emotion, I brought this up. And I just want to read it. However it ties in, I just think it's valuable to share. This, I was on a walk one day after my wife passed, and I always carry a hand recorder with me to jot down things, and I noticed something that led to me recording this, which I transcribed because I didn't want to lose it. And what I wrote is, a wave of sadness washes over me in the silence of the aloneness that accompanies me on my daily walk. Where some may attempt to avoid pain that comes from such sadness, I do not, for it is also part of the sum total of those experiences from which my life has been forged. Like the loss of innocence that can never be recaptured, losing one who became a part of your soul is a loss that can never be recaptured. I try to welcome the sadness, embrace it, encompass it, embody it, knowing even as I do so not to make it go away or avoid it, but do so to honor the loss represented by the sadness. And therein, not me in my situation, the hero's journey for me, what all this is about for me, is it's all part of life, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that's that's the water within which the fish swim for the fish, and the being of human beings for us. So I think it's important to look at life as that journey, as that adventure, our, you know, to make our place in it and embrace everything that comes our way. And by embrace, I don't mean we need to like it. You know, pain is pain. Suffering is suffering, but it's also all part of life. And I can clearly tell you in my life, no one sat and talked to me about that way, which is fine. You know, we pass on to our children what we do, the way we learn life and go about the business of life. And maybe one of the things about getting older is maybe there's more time to reflect on these things. But I'm probably rambling right now, but I think it's so important to recognize that all the things we make rules and standards are things that we accept and incorporate, not that we shouldn't, but to realize we have a certain responsibility in that, and it's important to have all of that be inclusive in the sum total of who we are in this game called life.
Vern, you're making me think of, and Kathy, I'd like to bring you.
I wanted to make you cry, Brian.
Oh, you certainly touched me, and I appreciate you sharing that. But it made me think of another stage in Campbell's journey called the ultimate boon. We covered that in season two, I think. But the ultimate boon is basically, well, what does the hero go on the journey for? And what strikes me is that in most of these lives and also all these movies and these books and all these different sources of media, so often once the hero or the individual gets the thing that they thought they were on the journey for, they realize that that thing wasn't the real boon. And as you were talking, Vern, I thought about how often in my own life and how often I've heard stories of other people's lives and how often in the movies and in good books, someone gets something and then they realize it was the expansion of their own appreciation of certain things. You mentioned, Vern, about even though the great pain of losing your wife, there's something there. You wouldn't call it something that you wanted, but still something valuable. And so as you were talking, I thought about how often what people think will be the ultimate boon or the ultimate payoff, whether it's Jack, whether it's sales, or Kathy, whether it's something that they're going for in education or in therapy, so often once they get that ultimate boon, they realize that it was sort of the expansion of consciousness that occurred on the way to getting what they thought they want, which was the real boon. So, Kathy, do you have any thoughts on that? I just found myself wanting you to comment on either that or what Vern just shared.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, that resonates with me. I think anyone that's gone through a dissertation gets to the end and kind of hesitates to hit that send button, because at least for me, once I got there, it was, well, that's it. Like, wait a second, now what? There was definitely a shift there for me. But as Vern was talking, something that really resonated with me was I didn't have a mentor or someone teach me any of this stuff either. And here I am in my 40s, finally learning how to accept challenges and just grab them and go, And so much of my time with Brian, when we talk about all of this, Brian, you've been a mentor in many ways, because it's helped me shift from, and I know you've said this before, and I feel like I hear your voice in my head a lot, but a shift in situations from things being nightmares to being adventures, and I've shared with Brian, there've been times where, everything happened all at once. A storm came through, bees were in my house. I mean, everything was falling apart. And I said, challenge accepted, bring it. What's the next challenge? What else is going to happen? And it was such a shift in my way of thinking, instead of sitting there dwelling on all the negative stuff that was going on, that really did feel like a nightmare in that moment of time, but being able to just be still and lean into the potential challenge and adventure of it made the world of a difference. And I would imagine the same could happen for a lot of people that are going through loss, changes in, job loss, familial loss, changes in transitions with jobs. I mean, you name it. being able to have that shift can be powerful.
Absolutely.
I think that's important, is taking that challenge perspective versus the problem perspective. Because basically, when you think about it, if you solve a problem, you only end up where you were before. So you haven't moved forward. Challenge. You've grown and you've learned as a result, and you're better off and stronger for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that's a great point. Solving problems puts you back to baseline. Taking on challenges makes you something bigger, broader, deeper. Well said.
You could think of taking on challenges as being the exercise gym for life.
Truly, yeah.
That's
funny
the way
that philosophers
look at it, is that basically any difficulty you face is like a wrestling partner. If you want to be a good wrestler, you seek out the toughest wrestler you can find and to match yourself against and to grow with. And if you look at problems that way, you're going to come out of it, assuming you survive, of course. There's always that, but you'll come out stronger.
Jack, it's funny you mention that, because the metaphor I sometimes use is the gym and weights.
Yeah.
That any good fitness person knows that that you want to take on heavier challenges in order to become in better shape, and it would be silly to imagine that the best thing to do is to just keep lifting the 5-pound weights even when your muscles can take the 10 or the 20 or the 25 pounders.
Yep, exactly right.
So I know we're getting close to, I got a little bit past our midpoint here, so I wanted to check in with the group and see, should we continue talking about where we've been, which is completely fine with me. I'm fine with a where we've been session. Or do we want to transition into where we want to go from here?
I think it's time to transition into where we're headed this season, this series. I think we've covered enough from where we've come, from whence we came, and I think it's time to move. But it's your show. I'm merely a host. My recommendation would be we're ready to move in and set the stage for the rest of the series this year.
Anyone against that?
No.
It's a journey.
That sounds good.
Got to keep moving.
Let's do it. Okay.
Otherwise, we're going to keep going round and round. We're going to get stuck on that rock in the river on the river rafting tour.
Yeah, we're not moving towards excellence.
we're stuck into excellence.
We're in a retrograde.
I have to say, one of my favorite psychological writers is Dr. Clara Hill. She's a counseling psychologist, and she said something that I have found to be true in myself and others, is that there is value in what she calls circling around insight. So I think part of the journey is going back to where we've been, like I think we did, and circling around it and saying, is there anything else in this?
Mm-hmm.
But I agree. I think we've circled around enough, and maybe it's time to move ahead. So one of the things that I thought I'd put out there that I imagine, knowing all of you like I do and having talked to you all individually or shared emails with you, I imagine you'll be able to relate to this. But one of the things that I get, no matter what system I'm working in, and I work in family systems, education systems, and work systems, whenever I talk about this stuff, whether it's the GREs, whether it's the Equality Wheel, whether it's the Hero's Journey, the feedback is pretty similar. And that feedback is, this stuff is obviously helpful to ourselves and others. This is obviously H2O. This is obviously excellence. And then right after that, I almost always get a question, why is this so rare? Why is the obviously good stuff for our systems so often huge problems in our systems? Why aren't we more genuine in our family systems? Why aren't we more regardful in our education systems? Why aren't we more empathic in our work systems? And I have a short answer and then I have a longer answer. And I'm going to propose that my longer answer might be a map for where we might go from here. My shorter answer is I don't think there's a lot of people who are really good at mission activation. And that's a term I use that basically means that if most of the most important things are getting done in relation to your mission, and to me, our mission is excellence promotion, with excellence being health to ourselves and others, that if most of those most important things are getting done on a regular basis in your system, that then you have mission activation. What I keep getting from people across a bunch of different systems, and I've spoken with John Spence, who's not with us now, but he's one of our guest stars, and he'll be with us again soon, I hope. He has confirmed this with his clients as well. When I ask people, give me a ballpark figure of what percentage of your mission got completed last year, it's usually somewhere between 10 and 30%. Which means 70 to 90% of what people wanted to get done aren't getting done. And I think that's the same with this H2O-centered excellence, this genuineness, regard, and empathy, that we're only getting small percentages of what we want done, done. So that's my short answer. We need more mission activation. The next question I usually get is, well, what the heck, well, what is that really, mission activation? It sounds nice, but what is it? And right now I've got six different phases of mission activation. Each one of these phases come with what I call an essential question. And I thought these different phases might be a good map for us in terms of what we can explore together moving forward. So what I'm going to do is very quickly just talk about these different phases and essential questions. And then I'll ask everybody if this seems like a good map for us to continue forward. If not, we'll throw around other ideas. And then I'll ask you what you all want to talk about if these different phases sound good to you. So to me, the first phase in mission activation, getting the most important things done most of the time, is what I call mission exploration. The essential question is, how much can we do together? And the way I like to help groups answer that question is through the acronym WATER, W-A-T-E-R. So we can do more together if what we want to do is well-defined, the W in WATER. We can do more together if our behaviors are aligned with what we want to do, the A in WATER. We can do more together if there's team ownership and buy-in of what it is that we want to get done, the T in WATER. We can do more together if we're good at execution, E in WATER. And we can do more together if the process and the outcomes are rewarding to people who are involved with the mission. The next phase in mission activation, from my perspective, is mission clarity. The essential question is, how do we want to do it? The acronym I use in trainings for this phase is SMART. The more specific our plans, the better. The more measurable our plans, the better. The more agreed upon our plans are, the better. The more realistic our plans are, the better. And the more time-bound or deadline-driven, the better. The next phase is what I call mission persistence. The essential question is, what's in the way? And the way that I think about this is, the same, very similar in terms of how do we want to do it. The difference between the second phase and the third phase is the third phase is how do we deal with what we were talking about before as problems or barriers or opportunities? How do we deal with those when they pop up? So once we have very specific, measurable, agreed upon, realistic, and time-bound plans, what do we do when those plans get interrupted with something? The way that we usually work with people in this phase is to create SMART solutions, specific, measurable, agreed upon, realistic, and time-bound solutions to barriers to progress. The fourth phase in mission activation is what I call mission synergy. The essential question is, are we all doing it together? There's an old saying I imagine you all are aware of, the idea that 80% of the work gets done by 20% of the people. So this phase of mission activation is all about getting everybody to contribute to the water levels of the group. The fifth phase in mission activation is what I call mission payoff. The essential question is, why are we doing it? What we do in this phase is dive deeper into the R in water, the reward. What we found is a lot of times things don't get completed because either the process of completing the mission is not rewarding or the outcomes associated with the mission are not rewarding. And then the sixth and final phase is what I like to call mission expertise. The essential question is, are we doing it well? And the acronym that I use when I'm training people in this phase is STEAM. We're more likely to do things well if we have the social support to do it. Kind of back to what Jack and Vern were talking about, social support for cigarette smoking. This would be social support for doing things at a super high level or an expert level. We're more likely to do things well if we have the time, the T in STEAM, to do these things well. We're more likely to do things well if we enjoy doing these things, the E in STEAM. The A in STEAM is accessibility. We're more likely to do things well if we have access to the information and materials necessary to become an expert or to maintain expertise. And then finally, we're more likely to do things well if we're well-motivated, the M in STEAM. So I thought these different phases might be a good framework for us to explore the mission of spreading more of this H2O-centered excellence, more of this genuineness, regard, and empathy, more of this equality wheel, more of this hero's journey to more education systems, to more family systems, to more work systems. So I'll probably stop there and see if you all think this is a decent enough map for where we want to go. If not, we can play around with other ideas. And if you like the map, then what is it that we want to begin talking about? I figure we could start in order with the first phase, or we could just bounce around to different phases.
Well, Brian, what I just heard, the way I heard you express what you did is fundamentally this our third season here is we're going to explore the journey into excellence, or let's see what we got, toward excellence at the level of group. We're going to go beyond the personal level. You've laid out we're going to explore some of the ways that we can accomplish that effectively. And I think that that's a great way to start it, kick it around. You've laid out some procedural things to, in fact, get us going. And as you started that, I chuckled why so many things seem to fail. Is I think that you can map some of the physical laws onto society, and it just seems like Newton's first law really applies here. The reason so many of us fail to achieve our goals is that first law is bodies at rest tend to stay at rest. Bodies in motion.
Yeah, and you know, go ahead and finish.
Yeah. No, bodies in motion tend to stay in motion, and you just laid out a great way to what it takes to start to get bodies in motion.
I think that's good. The other thing that comes to mind as you were talking is, Jack, I think you brought this up maybe in season one. Well, it could have been season two, but when I think of mission activation and these different phases, your pointing out of what I have found to be true comes to mind a lot, and that is when it's an individual against a system, the system tends to win.
Well, the actual quote is, a system wins every time. You put a good person in a bad system, and the system wins every time. So it's more than tends to, according to, I think it was Deming who said that.
I might be able to argue that. There seem to be a few people who even in really the worst systems were able to be helpful to themselves and others. But that's why I like the tends to win. But regardless, I would agree
with that. Few and far between, but it is possible.
But one of the things that I think about, I forget who brought this up, but on this topic, someone said that even in the most concreted areas, there's grass that sometimes figures a way to grow up amongst the cracks. And when I think about that in systems, I think, what would it be like if we stopped lathering concrete over the top of everybody and instead figured out ways in which to fertilize the soil? And that's really what a lot of what motivates my work on mission activation is, yes, I work with individuals and how to be that little blade of grass, that gets in between all the cracks in the concrete. But my biggest dream
is not
is
a weed,
that,
right?
Hopefully not. But even those weeds, if they make it, I think good on you, weed, But my my dream is that
to get rid of that.
But at my the biggest dream I have is that we all become better at systemically promoting this H2O, these GREs, these equality wheels, these heroic journeys. And I think once we become better at that, we really will shift into a whole nother mode of being, and maybe the next version of our species.
Brian, I like how you've mapped it out, and I've seen it in my own life, but then also in some of the systems I'm a part of, and I think this is a great conversation to have that could be very helpful for anyone listening too.
Great. So it sounds like this is a good enough map. Now, how do you all want to discuss it? Should we go in order? Do we want to sort of restrict what we're talking about to the first phase, mission exploration, with the essential question, how much can we do together? Do we want to just bounce around? What works best for you all?
Yeah, Brian, this is my input is the host of the show, is that every team has a leader. And I throw it to you to set out the path that we'll take forward, because what's that old saying? Too many cooks spoil the pudding, or whatever it is, So the thing that's powerful, I was thinking about this today as we're coming into this, is that everybody on a team is important in their own right, and and we often forget that, even though we tend to look at some people as more important than others, like the quarterback and football teams, or maybe the pitchers, things like that. But really, the team doesn't move forward unless it works as a team. And I'm going to call you the quarterback of this team. I'm going to pronounce you the quarterback of the team, and I'm going to have you lay out the map. There's if you are a sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain or something in the military, or you're someone like Hal Moore, who Jack has referenced beautifully in the past, leadership is taking the lead, and that's what makes the team work, like clockwork. So I'm going to take it away from a vote of the crowd here. I'm going to throw it all on you.
Wonderful. And whenever that happens to me, I always tell people, if I'm the leader, the first thing the leader's going to do is ask everybody what they want to do. So that makes me
don't be
think,
namby-pamby.
But that actually, you have actually maybe answered my question, where do we want to start? Because I think that speaks to the tea in water. Phase one, mission exploration, how much can we do together? I've studied enough about team dynamics and leadership to know. So let's get back maybe a little bit to, Jack, what you brought up. How often people don't know what it is they want, and I've seen literature that oftentimes people will ask for the opposite of what they actually want. So it's not that they don't, it's even worse than not knowing. It's, I will ask for the opposite of what I want.
Through not knowing what they actually want.
Yes, yes. And then sometimes if you're what's that, Jack?
Asking which one is it? If I ask for the opposite of what I want, am I doing that on purpose or am I doing that through ignorance?
I love that because this was going to be my next comment. And Kathy, maybe you'll have something to say about this. But one of the things that I have found, both in my own life and then when I was doing therapy with folks and parts of therapy groups, is oftentimes people will say that when they asked for something that was the opposite of what they wanted, they weren't aware at the time, but after they reflected, maybe this was a little another nod to Clara Hill, after they circled around insight, they found that somewhere in their unconscious or preconscious mind, they actually did know what they wanted and asked for the opposite. So I think in some cases, it's just luck. You know, they just say, I want you to be the quarterback, I have no idea what I really want, but I'm just going to say you be the quarterback. And in some cases, they'll say, I asked for you to be the quarterback because I wanted to be the quarterback, but I wanted you to do that so that we would have some kind of conflict. And I didn't realize that until now. So one of the things that I work on with people in terms of the team, the T in water, team buy-in, which helps to answer the question, how much can we do together? I think that the leadership models that map on best to teams that actually do synergize and all work together is that leaders actually, the best leaders are followers. And what I mean by that is that the best leaders, there's a little bit of Rogers in here, the best leaders help the entire team, sort of like we talked about with individuals, to carefully explore together what the entire team really wants. And oftentimes, and I think this has to do with some of the stuff that we talked about that's power control related, that we're just so used to systems that say there must be one leader who quarterbacks the entire team. But if you look at the actual data, the best leaders often say we're all co-quarterbacking. And what they get from that approach is team buy-in, the T in water. Kathy, do you have any thoughts on this? These are some of the things that we've talked about when we've talked about inclusion-centered leadership, equity-centered leadership.
Absolutely. I mean, even just thinking about our own interactions, you know, whenever you have invited me to have a voice at the table and just share my experiences and just be still and patient with me and giving me that space to reflect, you know, and really think about what I really want, rather than avoid conflict or, you know, say something that's incorrect because I don't want to be honest and and be courageous and,
yeah,
and whatever it is, you know, that space. And maybe it's my cultural background, maybe it's being a woman and just being socialized a certain way in this society, but I definitely very much feel like a co-creator and someone that can do the same for my team, go back into my system and sit there with folks and identify their strengths and give them their space to really flourish. Whereas that's not what I've been taught, you know, that was never what I was taught about leadership. But I do feel like it helps me do a better job when people lean in to me and my experience and my values and what I want. And I don't know if I'm answering your question, but that's kind of what just came.
Yeah, I think that's profound. One of the things, we're talking about this journey toward excellence, and one of the things that I find in groups within family systems, within education systems, and within work systems on this topic, who's our leader? that relates to the discussion we had earlier, asking for what you don't really want or need, or maybe even the opposite of what you want or need, is, are we really a we, or are we going to be some sort of version of the leader? And one of the things that came to mind, Vern, you many years ago encouraged me to watch The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And I don't know how many people, at first I thought, oh, a zombie show. Come on, I've seen Night of the Living Dead. I don't need more zombies in my life. But what I actually found is that so much of what's in The Walking Dead, I think, is like so many of the best shows and movies, it's just hero's journey stories, you know. And one of the things that just came to mind as Kathy was talking is there's a group headed by, there was, I know that this character has changed, but in his most power and control-y form, Negan was the leader of a group.
The Saviors.
And he encouraged, that's okay, you know this better than me. But what he encouraged in those Saviors was they would all say, I am Negan. Do you remember that, Vern?
Yes, absolutely.
I am Negan. Yes, everyone in the group would say, I am Negan, I am Negan, I am Negan. So what Negan did was said, I am the leader. You all will basically be versions of me and follow my vision and follow my mission. And I think one of the reasons why the essential question in mission exploration, the first phase from my perspective, and mission activation, why how much can we do together is so small in a lot of groups, is because they fall into this trap of saying we must all be little versions of the leader, as opposed to the most outstanding teams and groups and even movements. And those teams and groups and movements are, we are all ourselves and we are coming together to co-create, as Kathy said. We are co-creating our objectives. We are co-creating our goals. We are co-creating our activities. And what I found is that is the key to team buy-in, the tea in water. And if you co-create what this is, if everybody is a co-quarterback in some way, shape, or form, then the answer to the mission exploration question, how much can we do together, becomes much, much more.
The only place I would take is, I don't even know it's an issue, is everyone's a co-team member. And every, you know, like our physical bodies, we're not all co-hearts, we're kind of co-body. So everyone's part of the team, and there's no team without the agreement. There's no team leader. This seems so obvious to me. I've said it to people a lot of times. It struck me as when people talk about we need a great leader in the United States. Well, what we all seem to forget is that what it takes for a great leader is the led to agree upon who's going to lead them. I mean, this is an age-old theme through my life. They used to have a program on called Cochise, where the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Cochise were always trying to get the whites and the Indians together, but there were always the bucks that didn't agree on Cochise being the chief, and they wanted to go off their way. So if there's no agreement regarding the mission of the team, and that we are a team, there really is no leader. So I don't care. You can call them all co-quarterbacks. I'm kind of making a distinction that's real for me, is the team, every part of the machinery has to work together.
Yes. I don't know if this aligns with what you're saying, if it answers it anyway, but as you were talking, I thought about the W in water, the well-defined mission.
Yeah.
The alignment in water, that our behaviors are aligned with the mission. And then we've been talking about the T in water, team buy-in. And I think so much, well, the next letter in water is E, execution. What we found, and this has been around for so long in psychology, when you look into, well, what is motivating to people, what gets them to execute, you know, the E in water at higher and higher levels, And so much of it is related to being a co-creator in the endeavor. So those are some of the thoughts that came to my mind that I think there is this this habit maybe that we believe that there must be this one strong leader in a group and that's what's best for groups, but so much of that runs counter to the actual psychological data of what motivates people to do certain things that I really think that a much more empirically sound approach would be let's co-create as many of the objectives, goals, and activities in this group as possible, because I know if people are co-creators of their family systems, of their education systems, and their work systems, they're much more likely to do many more things in support of the mission.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
I don't know if that addresses.
I'd ask Jack from a business standpoint.
All this, and I agree with almost all you're saying, but you know me, I've got a slightly different point of view on this. You still need a leader. Somebody needs to be the leader. And I'm thinking of the British cabinet, the way it's designed. You have a prime minister. He's a first among equals, or she, depending on how this next election comes out. But there still has to be one person who is responsible for the success or failure of the team. You can delegate, you can give up a lot of your decision-making authority to everybody, but ultimately you can't just make it a five people on a team without a leader. I think is too many cooks all wanting to cook from a different menu.
Now, Jack, I've heard that. I know that's sort of a traditional way of thinking about leadership. Now, one of the things that comes to my mind as you were talking, I guess the A and E in water came to my mind as you were talking. Are you concerned that if there isn't one leader, that things will become misaligned, or that execution levels will go down? Is that a fair analysis?
Or you spend all your time trying to decide. You can't even get to well-defined if five different people have a different idea as to what needs to be done. When you talk about well-defined, it has to fit in some larger context. Is the leader answerable to stockholders? If it's a business, is the leader answerable to a larger organization? What is the larger purpose that they fit in, which is going to help define what that mission should be? So if you let five people, and I don't know why I'm thinking of five, but it could be any number, but if you let a whole group of people sit down and hammer it out, I think it's going to be difficult to define and to align. I also think human nature being what it is that there will be some people will emerge from the group discussion having more or less influence on the thought processes of the group as a whole.
Yeah, and everything you're saying is sort of traditional leadership theory. What do you... So one of the things that I have found, I think I'll put it this way, that when people who operate from that approach come to me and I ask them, okay, well, how much of your mission is getting completed? Like I said before, and like I referenced John as well, he and I have had a lot of discussions about this. The feedback we get is somewhere in the area of 10 to 30% of what we want done gets done. And then there's that old 80-20 rule that 20% or 80% of what gets done.
But how much of that 10 to 30% is failure in execution of a valid mission? And how much of it has to do with the planning fallacy where maybe the missions are overly ambitious for what the capabilities of the group are or what the situation allows.
Bingo.
Right?
I think what I have found in terms of the planning fallacy, which is, for people who haven't heard of that, the listeners who haven't heard of that, I think all of us have probably come across this, that it's the tendency to underestimate how much time certain things will take to get done.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And achieve.
And one of the reasons why, and maybe one of the major reasons, Jack, I think the planning fallacy is in play is because goals and activities are not co-created. So a leader, I can't tell you how many times I've encountered leaders and managers that say, well, I'll ask this person to do these 10 things, and they ought to be able to do it on top of the 50 other things that they're already doing. And the real expert in terms of how long it takes to do those 10 things is often the person they're delegating to.
Mm-hmm.
So the manager, because they're not co-creating, well, you know, I'm the leader, so I should you know, be in charge of who does what. They don't co-create it, and so they make plans, just like you said, that are so vulnerable to the planning fallacy because, number one, they're not in touch with the 50 things that all these people are doing that are already happening. And, Kathy, I'm thinking of some of our discussions about this over the weeks, too, so you might want to chime in on this. And so much of that gets solved, in my experience, by a co-creation of these things. And it runs counter to a lot of the traditional theory, but I think it's much more aligned with the evidence of what does actually minimize the planning fallacy. Kathy, do you have any thoughts on that? We've talked a lot about traditional leadership and how they can sometimes harm the execution levels of the people they're leading because they're not co-creating these things with the people that they're managing or leading.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I've seen it. I've observed it in others, and I've experienced it myself, too, in the past. And, you know, I think it can be really empowering when you do bring different voices to the table and allow a natural leader to emerge from the group. I think that's where you see the GREs really surface with a good leader too. At least in our field, that's been my experience. But when I've experienced people delegating or leading in a way that is very much similar to the power and control wheel where there is manipulation or, you know, they're trying to get you to buy into something that you don't really value, you don't really agree with, then there's potential for that person to quit. There's potential for that person to be overwhelmed, for them not to carry out the mission as well as they could, you know. And then there's failure, you know, with whatever mission it is, because they weren't empowered. They didn't have that voice at the table to really share and express their vision. And so, yeah, I've definitely seen that.
So a question comes up for me throughout. I'm hesitant to say that I agree or disagree. What comes up for me is really what, in terms of clearly defined topics, is really at the heart of this is what is leadership, what constitutes leadership, and what constitutes team.
Hmm.
And everything I heard Kathy just say, one of the things that keeps coming back is that people that aren't working on a goal that they're forced to really weren't on the team in the first place. And I don't hear Jack saying that the leader's job is to force people to do things against their will. I think leadership's a very strange thing, as I said earlier, is you have no leader without the agreement of the led.
I agree with you. I mean, I'm definitely not saying that you don't want team ownership. You don't want as much participation as you can reasonably have. I just don't want to go to the other extreme where you say there is no leader, that the whole group is responsible. Because I think that's utopian, and I just don't think it'll work.
Kathy and I were just speaking before the show.
When you say, Jack, but really quickly, utopian is a word that people use a lot to sort of discount an idea. I don't know if that's what you're doing. Are you saying that co-creation or sort of co-leadership is that the idea that co-leadership would create better outcomes than non-co-leadership, that would be a fable, that's pretend?
I don't know how you're defining co-leadership before I answer the question.
Okay.
What do you mean by co-leadership? Well, where nobody, there is no responsibility for results that rests in any one person. You're saying that everybody has equal input into the decisions that are made and equal responsibility for the results. Is that what you're defining as leadership?
I wonder if this would help. Maybe using this podcast as an example could help us explore this, because I think this is a really important idea. So when Vern said, you're the quarterback, you decide what order we're going to discuss these phases in. This is where I'm interested in exploring utopia, because to me, I think the utopian idea is that one leader will create the best outcomes, because it runs so counter to the evidence, you know? So to me, the traditional stuff's more utopian than what I'm talking about. And because I've seen the data on this.
Well, different people define utopia differently.
Yeah, that's what I asked you. What do you mean by utopia?
Utopian is a synonym for unrealistic. It's an ideal.
That's what I meant by it. And to me, one of the reasons why I reject non-collaborative leadership like I did in this podcast is because I think it is it's utopian to imagine that if I make the decision myself rather than with the entire group, that the execution levels will be better, because I know that
it depends on the situation. Are you familiar with the old idea of situational leadership?
Yeah.
I mean, if the house across the street catches fire, the fire chief isn't going to say, okay, guys, let's sit down and let's define what we want to do. And no, one person's going to say, you take this, you do that, and everything. So a lot of it depends on the situation. If it's a bunch of people sitting around saying, where should we build a fire station? That's a totally different thing, because it's much longer term. It's less urgent. You can get people around. You can build consensus. You can take input from every variety of person you can talk. But again, there is no one type of leadership that's going to be best for every situation.
I'm noticing we're at the end of our time, but I think this is a rich topic to dive into. And so I really want to put a pin in what's more utopian, this idea of one strong leader needed versus co-leadership needed. I really want to dive deeper into that, but I know I want to be respectful of everybody's time.
Everybody, you got to be respectful of your time. When I set these things up, I set them to go the full 2 hours, so we're still live and stuff right now. People need to leave. They need to leave. And Jack brought up a good point. One of the reasons that I appointed you, Brian, is that you're familiar with the structure of the acronyms,
mm-hmm.
the water, the steam, and everything else. So you seem to be the obvious choice for a leader to open up this discussion for us. And I love this topic.
Yeah, it's an important topic. And whenever I'm elected to be the leader, I do exactly what I did in the podcast, and I say, great, I'm the leader, and the leader
shirk
says, let's
responsibility.
Co-lead. And I
you have my vote.
I move away from the utopian idea that I could do better than we can do. But this is rich soil, and I really want to pick up from here the next time we get together, because I think this is essential to the question, how much can we do together the first phase of mission activation, mission exploration?
Well,
I think there's something missing from the water acronym, but I'll bring that up next time.
Good. I love it. No, wait a minute. I'm the leader, and you're not allowed to bring that up, Jack.
Well,
remember when you said, when I said you had my vote? There's also something known as with your feet.
I love it. I can't wait for the next one. This is great.
Go ahead, Jack. Finish. I want to hear what you had to say there.
Oh no, no. I just said that sometimes you can vote with your feet as well.
My point exactly.
Well,
see you all next time.
If we want to end it here, you know, it's been a thoroughly wonderful, enjoyable day. I'll kick in some lead-out music. Kathy, welcome aboard again. Loved it. Happy to have you on the team. And Jack and you guys, it's good to hear you both again, too.
Same here.
Yeah, great meeting up with everybody
again.
Thank
you so much.
Wow.
Absolutely. So, folks, signing off for this, our first Season 3, Episode 1 of Journey into Excellence. We will catch you next month.